Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist and man about town, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Duluth and Nothing But Duluth show. All will be explained a little bit later, or maybe we should explain it early on because it does have some special health interest. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio, special radio wave to the MSU Ronald G. Eaglin Space Science Center. And now it is time to introduce my co-medical host. First of all, back from an extended stint in Isonville, and ready to tackle.
Can't believe you hired her back.
Health
hey,
problems.
I only had to pound on the studio door for 15 minutes before you let me in.
Shelley Irving, Assistant Professor, University of Kentucky Physician Assistant Program. Welcome back, Shelley.
Thank you for letting me in.
And also from the University of Kentucky, the Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure, to tell you about our web presence, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can get the audio of the show at WMKY.org, Moorhead State Public Radio's website. There you can find the audio of the show. You can find a list of all the shows to go along with that audio link. Maybe you heard a little bit. Maybe you heard it all. Maybe somebody just told you about it. But either way, if you want to go back and hear it, you just find the Moorhead State Public Radio website, find Health Matters, and there you will find the show. After that, it's time to jump over to Facebook, facebook.com/HMRadioShow. That's a fan page. It's devoted to Health Matters. You can absolutely leave us all kinds of messages. You can let us know what you want to hear in the show. Maybe you got some comments on a show. Maybe you just got a question, or maybe you just didn't think that joke was funny. You know, it could be anything, but Facebook.com is absolutely where you would leave that for us. Again, you can find that fan page at facebook.com/HMRadioShow.
Our sponsor for today's show, the American Association Against Alzheimer's Disease, the AAAD. Their motto, where did we put that motto? And the American Association of Alzheimer's Disease wants you to know about things you can do to protect your brain, possibly to prevent Alzheimer's disease. Now, I put this on the show really because this annoyed me. They made it sound so easy to protect your brain against Alzheimer's disease. Simple things you can do to protect your brain from Alzheimer's disease. And in fact, it is very difficult and it is not that simple. But we will first talk about the finger study. Now, this is the Finnish Geriatric Intervention Study to Prevent Cognitive Impairment and Disability. From Finnish Geriatric Intervention Study to Prevent Cognitive Impairment and Disability, they get finger. I think that's Finnish Geriatric Finger. But I'm going to give you the finger now, and so that you will understand what we understand here at Health Matters about protecting you against Alzheimer's disease. It's the largest, longest randomized controlled trial focused on lifestyle interventions. 1,200 subjects followed for 2 years, ages 60 to 77. They were randomized to a study group. They received health interventions, including personal and nutritional counseling, exercise instruction from physical therapy, cognitive training, 7 medical exams, or the control group. They were just followed along. Cooking classes, cognitive training, exercise instruction carried out in groups in the study group. In the intervention group, the overall score is 25% higher compared with the control group. It was in the processing speed and executive function. They were a full 150% higher than in the intervention group than control group. In tests of organization and reasoning, they were 83% higher. Recall, memory did not improve with these interventions.
Now, did any of these subjects have any cognitive decline at the beginning of the study?
These were people who were cognitively normal. They had normal scores on their mental function tests, and so when they started the study. So this was a true prevention study. And so from this article, which I picked up from MDLinks, a person called Liz Mazeros wrote this. They said, well, here's what you could do. Exercise, 14 randomized controlled trials, 1,600 subjects, and a recent Cochrane review, which Cochrane, they basically try to synthesize information after we feel like we have enough research to know what we're talking about. Regular exercise may benefit older adults with mild to moderate dementia in completing the activities of daily living. Mediterranean diet. This is the diet based on fish, fruits and vegetables, olive oil, whole grains, nuts and seeds, limited red meat, moderate amounts of fish, poultry, and really, although they do allow dairy products, they are not a prominent part of the Mediterranean diet. They mentioned, and this disturbed me, they mentioned moderate consumption of alcohol may reduce the risk for cognitive decline. I think we are moving away from that, but that's what I think. And then they mentioned adequate sleep, undeniably associated with cognitive function. Recent review, poor sleep is a risk factor for cognitive decline and Alzheimer's disease. Perhaps a risk factor. The problem is it also could be an early sign of Alzheimer's disease. So we're going to try to break some of those things apart more in our second fractional portion, but I wanted our radio fans to be aware. And again, first of all, in this finger study, the idea of cooking classes, cognitive training and exercise instruction carried out in groups, the people loved it. They actually attended over 85%. Once you apparently you take some cooking classes with people and things like that, it's so much fun that you keep doing it.
Well, maybe it was the social stimulation
right.
that did it. So how do you control?
Yeah,
I mean, control for that?
What if the control group joined the choir or learned to do woodworking and these people did their
right.
Their diet classes? I don't know. I think, though, honestly, though, I think if you're looking for things to do, you're a retired person and you're sort of mapping things out. What are you going to do? Well, most retired people go to the gym and learn a language. I have a number of recent retirees. They all go to the gym and learn a language.
That was amazing, Tony. For a while there, I thought you meant they taught a second language at the gym.
Oh, that's a good point.
No, but you mean they do two distinctly different things.
Two activities. The people that I know that recently retired, they all decided to learn Spanish. They're all taking Spanish so that as a group they can go to Central America or somewhere like that. On the other hand, they go to Europe and they're all just lost. You would think a group of people who retire, they would have some experts on German or Dutch or Swiss or whatever. But no, they're all taking Spanish. But at any rate, maybe cooking classes.
Tony, does the idea of retiring and when you're retired going to the gym sound like something you want to retire for? I try to avoid the gym now.
I know what you're saying. I think, though, the idea, that's the time when you say, all right, I'm going to whip this body into shape. I'm going to make up for years and years of a desk job or I was too busy and so forth. Now that I've got time, I'm going to devote myself to the gym. And that's going to last, at least 6 months after you retire. Just like New Year's resolutions.
Mm.
It's going to, and then you see where it goes.
I promise you, I'm not going to make that resolution when I retire.
I like the finger study. I like especially the cooking classes. That was something, as you think about retirement, as you think about what you're going to do in golden years, getting really good at cooking seems like it would be a good thing. Then you can take advantage of whatever nutritional information comes out. Now, shifting gears, let's go to Duluth. I will tell you a little bit about Duluth, originally settled by the Sioux and the Chippewa tribes, are once home to more millionaires per capita than any other city in the world. The population of Duluth, 84,380 last census. The westernmost tip of Lake Superior, halfway between Minneapolis and the Canadian border. It is built into a steep, rocky cliffside, almost mountainous for the Midwest, ranges from 600 feet at the shoreline to 1,400 feet above sea level. Rated by Money Magazine, it's one of the top four Midwestern small cities based on livability. They have over 1,000 ocean-going and Great Lakes freighters annually. It is a big shipping center through the St. Lawrence Seaway and the Great Lakes. Physician population, over 400. One of every seven residents is employed in healthcare. Rated first in the U.S. for quality healthcare in a community of its size. Annual precipitation, 31 inches. Snowfall, 80 inches a year. The average January low is -2.
Yeah, that might do it for me.
You had me at 80 inches.
And the average July high temperature is 77. So you say to yourself, why does Health Matters care about Duluth? Why are we now promoting the city of Duluth? Well,
are we promoting the city of Duluth?
Oh, absolutely. Duluth is where we all need to be. Jesse Keenan, lecturer at Harvard University Graduate School of Design, at least daily, he studies urban development and climate adaptation. He gets a message from somebody saying, where should I move to keep myself safe from climate change? And he has been promoting climate-proof Duluth.
Climate-proof Duluth.
That's his phrase. Now, think about it for a minute. This is how this came about. We're about to hit 2020. Almost everyone had some type of strategic plan for 2020. Well, it's 2020. We need a new plan. What's our new plan going to be? I think we ought to have a plan for 2050.
You think just skip right over 30 and 40?
They don't mean anything. Say, here's my vision for 2030.
Really? You don't think people are going to go 2025?
No, it's too close.
I mean, don't we like quarters, though?
Yeah, but we had 20/20 vision. It was a great year.
But it sounds like
to
a great
a
way to get more money.
Yeah, and oh, so you're saying if you make it close enough, people will spend money on it.
Yeah, but you know, that way then you can go 2025, 2050.
Okay.
So you can start the quarters at that point.
You start the quarters. You say, all right, I'm giving up on 2020. We'll have a quick correction to 2020 by 2025,
right.
And then we'll do a 2050.
It is kind of hard to believe that we're 20 years past or going to be 20 years past Y2K.
Yeah, we're well into this century now.
20 years past Y2K. From a tech guy, that's our, you know, that's kind of our date, right?
Well, for me, growing up with duck and cover drills for a nuclear attack, I didn't think I would see 2000. I'm 20 years past due for getting annihilated.
Yeah.
That is the truth. When I was a young man, I figured, no way I'm going to see 2000. I mean, you know, Orwell was, Big Brother was 1984. I mean, we're past science fiction now.
See, Tony, when I was younger, all I thought about was 1999, right? Because that was the song, right?
Right. All right. So
see, I took a whole different outlook on it.
Back to Duluth, though. If you're making a 2050 plan, if you're saying, all right, we're not going to stop this climate change, the Southwest, millions of people living from rainfall to rainfall, is going to burn up.
No, it's not.
All right, let it be recorded here by our radio fans that Rick said the Southwest is going to be perfectly fine no matter what happens with climate change. We will see. I think there will be a reverse migration.
I just don't think in our lifetime we're going to see it.
If we get a 3 degrees centigrade
rise, you're talking about the guy who's not going to the gym when he retires.
Okay, but assume you make it to 2050, which seems doubtful to me, but if you do, then you're halfway to that 3 degrees rise in temperature that's going to put an extra meter, you know, of water in the ocean. So the Southeast, all the coastal cities will be underwater. Florida will be underwater. The rest of the Southeast, we've got that new tiger mosquito. We've got ticks now. It seems like we have a new different type of tick. We've got high pollen counts, and we're going to swelter. The Northeast, the coastal cities will all be underwater. The Midwest, obviously, everything's going to wash away with all the rains. And so you wind up, what's going to be left but Duluth? Sitting there on more fresh water than you can count, on the cliff.
Now it's going to be above zero in the winters.
As a matter of fact, they're predicting, Keenan's predicting, that it's going to be about the temperature of Toledo, Ohio, which is, frankly, where we all want to go. So now I've slammed two cities in one segment.
You know, the thing is I'm as north as I want to be right now.
Well, north is going to move north, and we're going to move out for a minute and take a break. Why don't you do so as well? You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Duluth and Nothing But Duluth Show. We are looking at 2050. We have changed our event horizon, and we're trying to figure out where would be a good place, a place similar to where Toledo, Ohio is right now. Which is what the predictions are, a place with plenty of fresh water, the Saudi Arabia of fresh water. Lake Superior could cover the entire North American and South American continent in water 1 foot deep. So there is lots of fresh water there, and that's going to be important going forward. So it looks like Duluth, 100. They have 86,000 people, or more or less, and their infrastructure can accommodate up to 150,000. There's plenty of room in Duluth. And it looks like a good place to be, at least according to the climate change expert at Harvard, Jesse Keenan, a lecturer there with the Graduate School of Design who studies climate adaptation. So that's how we got to our show. Our sponsor for the second time, the American Association Against Alzheimer's Disease, their motto, we're did we put that motto. Now, we talked last time about simple lifestyle changes to protect against cognitive decline. We talked about the finger study, which was intriguing because they had a bunch of retirees to take cooking classes, as well as exercise counseling and nutritional counseling and some cognitive training. And they found that they were better at executive function. They were able to, response time was 150% higher. They had better organization and reasoning skills. But recall, which is really the heart of Alzheimer's problem, memory, was not changed by any of these interventions. So this article in MD Links, it goes on to say, well, exercise is a good thing to do to prevent Alzheimer's disease. Unfortunately, 80% of Americans don't do 150 minutes of moderate intensity aerobic exercise every week. And those age 65 years and older have the lowest rates of physical activity, even though my friends are all going to the gym. 14 randomized controlled trials, 1,600 subjects with mild cognitive impairment. Researchers found a significant improvement in verbal fluency caused by physical exercise. Again, one of the things you will notice is they are measuring everything but memory. And Alzheimer's, I mean, it is a disease of cognitive function, executive function, but it is, if nothing else, a disease of memory. And that is something that there doesn't seem to be much change for. Mediterranean diet, we talked about it. Fruits, vegetables, olive oil, whole grains, nuts, seeds, and beans. Not so much meat, not so much beef, certainly, and light on dairy products. It is good. It is a good heart-healthy diet. It also may protect against Alzheimer's disease, although I got some more information on that. Moderate consumption of alcohol, I really don't like that they even mention it. Currently, no one is recommended drinking to fight cognitive decline or Alzheimer's disease. And I don't think they will. Alcohol is associated with higher rates of cancer. It has been disappointing in its protective effects against stroke. And then sleep. Try to get 7 or 8 hours of sleep. Poor sleep, a risk factor or perhaps a marker for Alzheimer's disease. That's our sponsor, the American Association Against Alzheimer's Disease. Now, in that line, I'm finished. I'm going to put Duluth aside, but I want our radio fans to change your event horizon. Rick may be right. We'll do corrections to 2025 of all the things we got wrong for 2020. But at some point, we need a new plan. And this new plan has to include the inevitability that global temperatures are going to rise, and we have to start thinking about where we're going to go. And I think if I can make a recommendation, retiring on the coast is a bad idea. Not going to work.
You think so?
If I retired on the coast, I would probably buy a motorhome.
Well, but
and I would just start, put it in first gear, and I would just rumble inland as the sea levels rise.
I think there's also, you know, yeah, great, the sea levels are going to rise, but, you know, the coast is not exactly a cheap place to live.
Nope.
Right? It's hard to retire there if you haven't planned for it for the last 25 years.
Unless it's the coast of Lake Superior.
Now the cool thing is you. Well, I get what you're saying, but I'm not gonna. I don't agree to the premise of your answer. But you could buy land about 50 miles inland from the coast, so that in 50 years you actually have beachfront property.
It will be on the coast.
Yeah, I mean, there's a thought there. You buy the high point in town. You know, you make sure that you buy the high point in town. The problem is, you know, we're going to see increased intensity storms. We already have. And I think it's going to make it very difficult. You can't just simply get a map and map out where the beach will be. I don't know what the beach will be or what it will look like, but I think it will be evolving. I'll put it that way. Lots to think about in terms of what you want to do with retirement. And in order to think about that, I recommend you put on your thinking cap. Nature Neuroscience, April 9th, tells you how to put on your thinking cap. This is the Center for Systems Neuroscience at Boston University. A couple of things they found. First of all, they believe, based on, it looks like, functional MRI studies, deficits in memory, and this is working memory, this is where Alzheimer's affects you, that happens from specific brain circuits becoming uncoupled or disconnected. You have a connection that creates a memory, and then it disconnects, and that's a problem. Now, what they did then, they took 42 adults in their 20s and 42 adults ages 60 to 76. All of them completed a working memory task while brain activity was being monitored on an EEG. Now, without anybody knowing, half of them got electromagnetic stimulation through their thinking cap. They stimulated the brain with electrical activity. They didn't shock the person, but they created a magnetic field. The people couldn't feel it. The researchers and the people didn't know whether they were getting it or not. And then they had them doing these tasks. There was increased interactions in certain brain rhythms in the people who got stimulated. Before any brain stimulation, the older adults were slower and less accurate than the younger adults. This is discouraging to me. Slower and less accurate, the old guys.
Well, it is what it is.
I mean, yeah, it is. Kind of expected that, didn't you?
Well, the older adults, while receiving brain stimulation, their working memory test scores improved to the levels of the younger participants. I can make you think like a 20-year-old by creating an electric field around your brain. It was rapid. It lasted for at least 50 minutes after the stimulation was stopped. And that's all they know.
50
minutes. Now, what happens if you did it again next week? What happened if you did it repeatedly? I don't know. Now, we have talked about this brain stimulation over and over again. We have those helmets that people wear while they're in video games to try to increase the reaction and response times. This is another version of that. This functional connectivity, this is a problem of Parkinson's disease, schizophrenia, autism, lots of things. So what if we did electromagnetic brain stimulation? What would that do? It is not known whether repeat stimulation would generate activity patterns that would persist. Would you wear a magnet cap if it made you think faster?
No.
You're saying, okay, no. I am where I am.
I would need to see more information on that, because what are the side effects?
Yeah, that's not known. The long-term benefits or the detrimental effects long-term, not known.
Would I eventually stop sleeping?
Right. Would you become schizophrenic? Would you have nightmares? Would you be unable to think without it? You become physically or psychologically dependent on your thinking cap.
Do I think better when I'm facing north?
Only if you're in Duluth.
Yeah. I think it, though, you know, I mean, let's face it, we do right now. We take caffeine. Many of us take caffeine in order to be able to move, to react faster and think more clearly at work. You know, you get that cup of coffee at work. We are comfortable at this point with some stimulant medications. And students, whether they need them or not, students are taking ADHD drugs to try to improve their thinking. We've talked for a long time about the possibility then of electromagnetic stimulation to try to improve test scores and so forth. This is another study in a line of studies indicating that magnetic stimulation of the brain seems to do something. And this was nicely done. Like I said, blinded. No one knew whether they're being stimulated or not till they got the test scores in. And then they looked, and lo and behold, these scorers did better. Now, I mentioned about the healthy diet. That was one of the things the Alzheimer's disease people said. This was a study in the AMA Journal from the United Kingdom. People on the average 50 years old. They calculated the healthy eating index score, 11 food categories, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, things like that. How much of this did you eat a day? And after 25 years, these 50-year-olds, 4% of them were diagnosed with dementia, and it didn't matter whether they ate healthy or not.
That's discouraging.
Or encouraging. If you're eating healthy, Shelley, it's very discouraging. For me, it just makes me feel like, okay.
I just feel bad for all the donuts and tacos they missed.
Yeah.
For nothing.
So, I mean, it's really hard to figure out what's good news, isn't it? You can't prevent Alzheimer's disease. That's sad. You can eat potato chips. Well, that's great. I mean, this stuff, it's not healthy. It does raise your sugar. It doesn't create muscle mass. It's not a good idea. But we cannot say that if you would just eat the right foods, you wouldn't get Alzheimer's disease. And that's one of the changes that everybody talks about, the Mediterranean diet or other diets. And at least in this unit, and this is just one piece of the puzzle. Now, you know, they got a bunch of people together, watched what they ate, and it didn't matter.
Do you think what type of dementia someone may have, that some of these things may be beneficial? For example, if someone has a vascular dementia, then maybe the Mediterranean diet is helpful.
Yeah. I think to some degree, yes. Now, when we talk about dementia means that your brain is not functioning as well. There are many types of dementia. Vascular dementia means that you may have strokes or many strokes. There is a dementia with Lewy bodies that is a really nasty dementia that has hallucinations and agitation. Frontotemporal behavioral issues are very prominent, and people become angry and swear and do things that they never did when they were young. And then Alzheimer's is kind of almost like a wastebasket. Most of the people that have dementia have an Alzheimer's type dementia, meaning they didn't have strokes. There's nothing appears to be wrong with the frontal temporal lobes. There's not any evidence of Lewy bodies. And so we say, okay, this must be Alzheimer's disease. And it's, what, 80% or more of all dementias are the Alzheimer type dementia, where the only thing we can see if we get a PET scan, we can see some of these neurofibrillary tangles or plaques in the brain, and we say that's probably Alzheimer disease. So perhaps then if we split the dementia out, now they didn't in this diet study, but perhaps that would make a difference. I have been hammering on this, but I want to hit it again. There was a Cochrane review. Now, the Cochrane people, they look at all the evidence for and against a thing, an intervention, a medicine, and so forth. They did a review on memantine. That's Namenda. It is one of the drugs that's commonly used for Alzheimer's disease. And they looked at people who were either on other medications or weren't, with severe, with moderate, with mild Alzheimer's disease or mild cognitive impairment. And essentially, they saw some very, very small benefits on certain test scores, but it was really hard to see any measurable, for you, the family member, measurable difference. And I told Shelley when we were talking about this, I'm going to just read this because this was chilling to me. I'm quoting the authors here. The differences in Alzheimer's disease make it unlikely that any single drug will have a large effect. And that means the optimal treatment may involve multiple drugs, each having an effect size that may be less than the minimum clinically important difference. What we are saying then is if you or someone you love has Alzheimer's disease, we want to prescribe a cocktail of different drugs, except none of those drugs produces a measurable difference by itself.
And the patient has dementia, so we may not even know if it helps.
If it helps at all.
Bit.
This has been my argument with Alzheimer's drugs all along. There are a lot of over-the-counter things, brain stimulations, and all sorts of supplements. They don't work, and the FDA is in the process of cracking down on them. But I think we have to look realistically at the prescription medicines. And the effect sizes are so small that the experts are saying, singly, by themselves, we may not be able to tell any difference with these drugs.
It's depressing, you know, and you can see from taking care of these patients how desperate the families are and sometimes the patients themselves to find something that will do anything that they perceive might be helpful.
Yeah. I personally think sometimes you can use those medicines and maybe change a behavior, a level of agitation, people trying to bolt out the doors or people who are become angry. You may be able to soften that a little bit. I don't see any evidence at all that you can make that person think better or remember better. As a matter of fact, I probably would put the magnetic hats in front of these drugs because they at least have a chance of making them think better. Keep in mind, even the magnetic caps did not improve recall. They improved executive function but not recall. That is a hard, hard nut to crack. And right now, I think we are being misled regarding the medications. We are certainly being misled regarding the supplements. I'm not even sure about the lifestyle interventions when you see what the evidence is on a diet. I think exercise is good. I think, first of all, it's not harmful. You're not going to waste a lot of money on exercise, hopefully, because exercise is a good thing to do anyway. But exercise may be a good thing to do. I want to shift gears a little bit. This was from Reuters, April 3rd. Published in the American Journal of Public Health, the states where it is illegal to text while driving seem to have fewer emergency room visits for crash injuries than those who don't. And the visits dropped after those laws took effect. On the average, states saw 1,600 fewer traffic-related emergency room visits per year after implementing a texting ban. I think we all feel that texting is another person's problem. We have seen evidence of people who just sit there when the light turns green or people who rear-end somebody when the light is not green. Dangerous behaviors. But fortunately, we are not that person. We can multitask.
I tell you, it's things like this, Tony, I have a tendency to possibly get out there towards the deep end and get upset. You know, I totally understand that texting and driving is a bad thing. You shouldn't do it, right? We should be punished if we do. So I'm not trying to stand up for this, but I think sometimes these things are poorly worded. You know, because I text and drive all the time, but I use hands-free. I'm talking to my phone, no different than other people talking on a regular phone call while you're driving hands-free. And I think at some point we have to make a distinction between a hands-free operation on a phone and not doing anything at all.
Right? But are you still equally mentally distracted?
That doesn't matter. I'm distracted when I'm eating a cheeseburger. They don't outlaw that.
Well, I think
I'm saying we have to be really serious about this.
Yeah, and Rick, I think that's been your strongest argument. I mean, it's the same way we campaign against drunk driving because we can measure drunk driving. We have a cutoff. We have a field test. But when you talk about drugged driving, distracted driving, there is nothing that, there's nothing you can say, all right, this is too much of a distraction. So we ban eating in the car. We ban makeup. We take the mirrors out of the visors because no one should be looking in a mirror while they're driving a car unless it's to check traffic. We remove the radio. We get rid of the billboards along the sides of the road. I mean, so where,
yeah, what where
distractions
right,
are
right.
tolerable,
where
what are not.
The distraction. And that's my problem. We need to properly word these rules and say, look, you must have one, you know, one or two. You can talk about how many hands do you have to have on the wheel at a time, right? You know, there has to be some way to get you from touching your phone and texting a response. Somehow or another, typing and driving are to be illegal. Do you type in the radio selection on the touchscreen?
You can, obviously. Yeah.
You know, see where I'm going here?
Yeah, so maybe you need only, all right, we'll limit the number of radio stations to, say, four. If you have more than four radio stations on your radio, then you're spending too much time tuning your radio.
No, I'm not suggesting that we're going to solve this problem in the next 28 seconds. What I'm suggesting is it needs more thought than just don't text and drive.
But that keeps people out of the emergency room.
Well,
now I don't know about how many radio stations.
Maybe if we set it right,
we
keep more out of the ER.
Yeah. Yeah. There may be something else. That has been consistently your best argument, and I'll acknowledge that argument. That this is not the only distracting thing, and it may not be the most distracting thing.
Right. The most distracting thing is
break time. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Duluth and Nothing But Duluth show.
You should have called it the Cutoff Show.
Well,
I had something really important to say there, and you just went to break. But you know what? I'm not saying it now.
I know. Rick gets a little bit sullen when we start talking about texting.
I prefer you say salty.
Okay.
Salty.
Salty.
Okay.
He gets a little salty when we talk about living on the seashore. Duluth, Minnesota, the place to be in 2050. As the climate warms, Duluth will gradually transition to a Toledo, Ohio-like environment alongside the greatest body of fresh water in North America. And let's face it, you know, you think about the people in the Southwest living from rainfall to rainfall, and then you look at those people in Duluth and you think, well, where's the sensible place to go? Some people feel that water is going to be the new oil. That is, the battles or wars are going to be fought over water access, and there is Duluth sitting on more water than you could even shake a stick at. So, once again, we at Health Matters, enthusiastic Duluthers. We have to figure out what you call a Duluthite, Duluthian.
Duluthian?
Something. We like Duluth. Certainly better than those Florida cities. And much less crowded, as it happens. Our sponsor for the final time, American Association Against Alzheimer's Disease. Motto, where did we put that motto? A couple of other things I want to mention. This is old. This is back in 2017, but I wanted to remind you, the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, they came out with three recommendations. There are three things that encouraging but inconclusive evidence supports them. Cognitive training, enhancing reasoning. And this has really fallen off the map, hasn't it? The yeah. idea that you do cognitive training. I mean, in the sense of, again, taking the foreign language or working puzzles, I think we agree to that. but a specific training exercise, a cognitive training exercise to try to improve your memory, not as enthusiastic as we were back in 2017. Blood pressure management, something we've not talked about, but there has been a decline in the incidence of dementia. Perhaps some of the Alzheimer's dementia was actually, as you mentioned, a vascular dementia, but for whatever reason, the rates have been lowered as we become very serious about blood pressure management. There was a very large trial called the SPRINT trial. They tried to show that aggressive lowering of the blood pressure below 120 would help with cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's disease, and this study, in my judgment, failed to show a benefit. And then finally, says the National Academy of Science and Engineering Medicine, once again, increased physical activity. So we're seeing that coming from multiple sources, increase your physical activity. That's the one thing it seems that we all can agree on. Now, across the pond, in the United Kingdom, the Lancet Commission on Dementia Prevention, Intervention, and Care, they've got actually a much more sophisticated and more broad approach to dementia. They identified 9 lifestyle factors that made up 35% of your risk. Midlife hearing loss, 9% of the risk. They strongly recommend that you protect your ears, but also that you consider hearing aids as soon as you start to develop hearing loss. And again, this may be a part of interacting with other people. That may be where that comes up. If you take the cooking class and you can't hear the directions, you don't learn how to cook, and you also don't interact with your fellow cooking students. Early life education, making up 8%. I think that's been debunked. The rate of decline is similar whether you're educated or not. You have a little more reserve if you're more educated, but they thought 8%. Later life smoking, we can certainly actually, I am not sure that smoking carries a risk for Alzheimer's disease. The latest I just saw, and I didn't bring it to the show, just saw a paper indicating we're not sure about that. Late life depression, 4%. Physical inactivity, 3%. And again, it seems that every source is in agreement on that. Social isolation, 2%, and they have a minister of loneliness to try to improve their social isolation in the United Kingdom. Hypertension, 2%. They agree with the United States that we need to be aggressive in treating high blood pressure, although the most aggressive treatment trial of high blood pressure did not reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease. Later life diabetes, 1%. Midlife obesity, 1%. And they said, so you must try to address these things, say the researchers in the United Kingdom. So there you have it from a silly article here from the Cochrane Review of Medications, from the National Academy of Science and Engineering Medicine, and from the its British equivalent, the things that you can or can't do to try to prevent yourself from becoming demented. That's our sponsor, the American Association Against Alzheimer's Disease. April 12th, CBS Associated Press, ER visits nearly doubled, for kids under 6 swallowing stuff and coming to the ER. You look at 2015 versus 1995, we're talking about a 20-year period, the number of ER visits jumped from 22,000 up to 43,000.
I can see that.
Increasing number of consumer products use button-sized batteries. Mm-hmm. That's TV remotes, digital thermometers, remote control toys, and so forth. And those batteries, if your digestive juices digest that battery, it makes some very toxic substances. If your child, if you think your child, your infant or your young child has swallowed a battery, you've got to get that battery out. You've got to get them to some professional help for that, because that will eat a hole in their stomach and cause some really bad things. The other thing is magnets. Again, one magnet, no problem. Two magnets, they stick together in the bowels, and they can poke a hole in the bowel. Basically, they pinch the bowel between the magnets. Almost 800,000 children treated during the study years, and again, that's over 20 years. Coins, batteries, and toys, most of the visits. Now, coins, not an issue. You just look for change in their bowel movements, and you're good.
Did you need a drum roll there, or I'm trying to figure out if that was
that's
a sentence
my, that's
or a
favorite.
Pun?
Have you noticed any change in your bowel movements? but honestly, you swallow a coin, and most of the time that's going to be fine. We've brought onto this show stories about parents who used a metal detector to watch the coin go through the bowels, and out it comes, and everything's fine. They are rarely a problem, and you don't even need X-rays to track them. it appears. But the batteries and the magnets are the things. They must be addressed. You simply cannot leave that in. There's really a severe danger to your kid.
And you have to make sure that they're actually in the bowel. They've gone through the stomach, not down into the lungs.
That's a good point as well. Of all the risks we want to talk to our kids about, it's such a simple thing to make them aware that these magnets and these batteries could cause serious injury and keep them not only away from their mouth, but any other opening in their body. And I did have to take my daughter to the emergency room because she put things up her nose.
Well, it happens.
Yeah, I don't understand it. I mean, I understand, you know, kids have an oral fixation. They suck on things. They swallow things. Why anyone puts things up their nose is still a mystery to me. What is the plan?
I don't think there was a plan.
No. Well,
there was
something.
A space. Said,
you know,
there
this
was a,
would go.
A cavity.
But you look at this thing and you think, I bet that would go up my nose. And I mean, there has to be some thought involved. It's not like it accidentally goes up your nose.
No, there's no thought involved. How old was she?
She was young.
Okay, there was no thought involved.
I think there was stupid. I think there was thought, but it was stupid. And I will not name my child's name. You have to guess because to avoid embarrassment, even though my kids don't listen to the show anyway. All right, here's three articles that hit my desk within a week. And I said, okay, these things may not be related, but they seem related. First of all, this came from Stat News, April 4th. Amazon's Alexa is now HIPAA compliant.
I'm pretty sure my Alexa has not gone through HIPAA training.
There are six voice programs built by large health businesses, from Boston Children's Hospital to Cigna Insurance, allow patients to use Alexa to access personalized information, such as updates after surgery, prescription delivery notifications, nearby urgent care centers. Vanderbilt University, I know, is working on integrating an Alexa into their electronic medical record so that rather than typing information in and doing searches, you can simply ask Alexa to do it for you. So this is a big deal. Rick, I'm assuming that this voice recognition, whether it's an Alexa-type device or something, is going to be our future interface with our computers.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, while it may be Alexa or the Echo, it might be the HomePod and Siri, it might be the, you know, Google Voice. And there's a whole bunch of things it could be. I think more importantly, there's an underlying current flowing of voice recognition and how to add analytics based on voice recognition. I think, you know, is it going to be this? Who knows? You know, in 5 years, it could be totally different. But I think the amazing part is how they have now pretty much gotten these things with a medical vocabulary and the ability to decipher complex medical phrases to the point where they can actually feel comfortable that they can actually be an assistant in a room, at least on some degree. And
right.
I think that's pretty amazing.
Now, this really fulfills, I think,
now,
eventually.
I think, no, Tony, I think, let's add something else. I think there's a huge topic coming up that hasn't really been discussed, and I think you'll see it play out in the next couple of years. The first, when we started doing telemedicine back in the 90s, the one thing we couldn't get was we couldn't, because it was a different modality, we couldn't really get paid in a different way, right? So we went through years of trying to get legislation and insurance companies to buy in and agree that there is some technology charge that has to occur to build out the technology to provide the same doctor consultation that you couldn't get because of a health shortage area or something like that. I think what you're going to see now is rather than have somebody in the room either helping with the electronic medical record or transcribing, I think what you're going to see is we're going to be doing that through an Alexa. And the question is that really an extension of the doctor? Or is that something they can bill for, or is it something they can't? And I think you're going to see that argument. Now, it may be easily negated. It may be easily solved. But I think we're going to get into how do you deal with a digital assistant financially.
Right. So just
is it going to have its own charge code?
Think about that for a minute. If we sat an Alexa down and gave Alexa access, first of all, I would be examining my patient. I would say, Alexa, when was the last colonoscopy? Alexa, what's her potassium level? Alexa, did we get that
I would back up a little bit, Tony. I think what you're going to see is you're going to see Alexa in the room listening, and she's going to be documenting the visit.
Right.
She's going to be providing all the verbal parts of the history and physical. You're going to be saying, I just did this, and I got this. I just did this, and I got that. And that's going to end up in the record in a written form.
Or with artificial intelligence, I'm simply talking to the patient, and Alexa is creating a document that
sure.
documents that.
But she can't see you smack their knee for reflexes.
Right, we would video that most likely. I think that if we get the memory. And again,
but you could vocalize it. That's not something you need video evidence
of. I could tell her. But we're looking now, again, we're with Duluth in mind. We're looking at 2050. We're looking ahead to this, and we could see how finally the promise of the electronic medical record. Right now, it is so bad we have to hire scribes to work with it, whereas we didn't need them before because it is worse than paper in terms of documentation. It really is a horrible thing. So this is the beginning then of the corrections. To create the real electronic medical record we thought we all had to have. This is, in my mind, a wonderful thing. The other thing, as far as Amazon goes, Amazon has been working for quite some time trying to enter the healthcare market. They have bought the online pharmacy pill pack, so you may be able to get your medicines delivered, I suppose, by a drone from Amazon. To ship and sell prescription drugs. They also have a Comprehend Medical, a machine learning tool that allows users to extract clinical information from text in the patient's records. So if I just happen to be dictating along, it will pull out the who's married, who's not, when you first had your surgery, things like that, and create then the type of spreadsheet that we need to really to track you. And all I've got to do is just dictate, and it will organize my dictations. So you can see where Amazon's going. They are organizing dictations. They are creating HIPAA-compliant speech recognition devices. They are, in fact, they're going to sell you your pills, which is kind of exciting. And you can see where this would go with the electronic medical record. Good news, good news, good news, right? And then, a week later, the 11th, this is from Bloomberg, thousands of Amazon workers listen to private Alexa chats. They don't have access to personal identifying information such as account details, but the recordings sent to Alexa include account number, first name, and device's serial number. So we talk about it being HIPAA compliant, but also Amazon is famous for pulling that information off and tailoring their next screen or their next interaction with you based on what they know about your last interaction. And I just don't think they can leave that alone. This was, again, Bloomberg broke this because it was unbeknownst to most people that, in fact, in order, again, they say, well, this is quality control, but their people are listening to your conversations with Alexa. Rick, you were talking about the doorbell people and the thermostat people.
Well, I mean, I think there's other companies now that I think it's coming to light. I think Nest security camera or Nest thermometers have kind of openly admitted now that they have cameras built into their thermometers that are there for future use, right? So I think I think there's people who have seen cameras in Coke Freestyle systems, right? So I think there are different systems you're going to see that are out there that are going to start putting baby cameras in, mm-hmm. so that they can start getting visual information to go along with the audio and the
and
surroundings.
Finally, also on the 11th, healthcare is the number one industry affected by data breaches. We lose more information in healthcare. We'll collect your Social Security number and then we'll hand it out. And so,
let's be honest, Tony. We try not to. Let's at least give them credit. They try not to.
But
there's too many ways. I mean, there's just a lot of ways for data to leak.
Yeah. Now, what that means then, Rick, is you are a cybersecurity expert. What if you come into my office and I say, hey, Rick, look what I've got. I've got a new Alexa here. She's going to be recording everything, all of her interactions. Isn't that great? Let's talk about your sex life or whatever, and she'll record the documentation in a HIPAA-compliant fashion.
Are you asking me what I would say?
Yeah.
You first.
Do you have a discomfort?
No, I do not. Okay. I do not have it, but only because I think, now granted, these systems are only as good as the engineering that's been put behind them, right? So we look at this, and to us, it looks more like a black box. On the technology side, if it's implemented correctly and it follows compliant protocols, and then I don't really have a problem with that because, again, I see technology work the way it's supposed to. I do believe there's gloom and doomers out there that just don't want anybody to know, and they're always suspicious. The thing is, we have to be able to give a little bit to let the data do some work for us. If we're willing to give a little bit and we think the systems are built correctly, then the good side of that is going to outweigh the bad 10 to 1. And so I'm willing to go with it, but not everybody believes the same thing as me. Some of this stuff takes time to...
You know, I think if something as simple as vaccines triggers the kind of violent response we've seen, I can imagine this also, there being people who just don't trust this at all. And it's going to be, like I said, 2050 is going to be very interesting. Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.